COVID restrictions remain unchanged despite worsening numbers. School funding gaps widen, plus Chicago's quarantine policy for Hoosiers, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 16th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced he won't reimpose any COVID-19 restrictions, despite all of the state's guiding principles heading in the wrong direction. Hospitalizations are at levels not seen since May. The average number of new cases has jumped 93% since Holcomb rescinded almost all restrictions. The positivity rate has increased 20% in that time, and some hospital systems are experiencing staffing shortages. Holcomb stresses the need for personal responsibility. He says the state is focused on providing support to local communities that experience spikes in cases.
Just like everything else we do around here, we have to look at the root causes. And assuming that some blanket response will solve it, that's being proven inaccurate.
Holcomb points to similar COVID surges around the country and the world. The governor also continued his statewide mask order. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dr. Woody Myers says Holcomb is, quote, frozen in the intensifying spotlight. Myers, a former state health commissioner, calls Holcomb's response a lack of leadership.
So we're going to let 92 different approaches occur in 92 different counties based upon a color-coded map that changes weekly as the numbers, which are delayed, get reported. That makes no sense from a public health standpoint.
Myers says he would reimpose capacity limits on bars and restaurants and implement consequences for not following proper COVID precautions, including potentially fines. Libertarian gubernatorial candidate Donald Rainwater says every Hoosier must do what they believe is appropriate for themselves, their families, their churches, and their businesses. Is the governor's regular refrain about making data-driven decisions around COVID still believable? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is there anything the government can really do if people don't do the right thing?
You know, I'm really kind of tired of the government, which is sending out conflicting messages to people, blaming the people for this. You know, on the other hand, the governor, for example, said that if the numbers start going in the wrong direction, he would reverse it and tell people not to gather in large groups and not to go to bars and maybe even put, who knows, some kind of a penalty on the non-mask wearing. Instead, he's completely folded because he's so deathly afraid of a call from Donald Trump expressing displeasure with his decision, just like on anybody can have an absentee ballot. He wouldn't even go for that despite the pandemic. I mean, people can be honestly confused about this when you have a president who says, don't be afraid of it, it's no big deal, it's in the rearview mirror, you don't have to worry about it. A governor opening up practically everything except for asking people to social distance and wear masks. You can understand why people are confused and why the behavior changes, which is why if the governor is going to have any credibility at all and is going to convince people that he wasn't lying when he said he'd follow the data, he has to go back and close or at least restrict in some fashion the gatherings which are causing this. I know he's got pressure from the right wing of his party. I understand that. I understand he's afraid of Donald Trump. But the numbers today are 2,000 infections in one day. He has got to step up and provide some leadership.
I want to update some numbers that you heard in the piece at the start of the show because I wrote that yesterday, so of course they're now outdated. Since the governor went to stage five through today, the average number of new cases is up 101%. And the positivity rate is up 45%. How can you look at those numbers and say we're going to stay where we are in stage five?
Well, I think, first of all, part of it is also about hospitalizations, supplies. I mean, there have been, as we have gone through this, there are different phases and different reasons for the decisions throughout that process. Number one, yes, the governor is looking at the data and talking to medical professionals and making decisions based on that. You have Democrats who want to shut everything down, and we can't afford to shut everything down, and people don't want to shut everything down. And so it's really, we're getting to the point, I think, where people, there's fatigue about it, right? There's fatigue about wearing masks, there's fatigue about social distancing, and I think people have let their guard down too much, and now we're seeing some of the results of that. But, you know, we just have to kind of get back on track and make smart decisions. But at the end of the day, people, it is an individual responsibility, and people are going to make decisions for themselves and their own families. And you know that there are different levels of risk based on what you're doing. And you have to kind of operate under that assumption and do what we can to keep the most vulnerable, you know, senior citizens and folks who may have other conditions that put them more at risk. We have to make sure that they are protected while not completely shutting down our economy and our jobs.
Nobody's talking about shutting down the entire economy. Nobody's talking about that. But they are talking about restricting the numbers of people gathering. And by the way, nursing homes are being affected by this upsurge also. So we're not protecting the ones that are most vulnerable.
But the kinds of things that your candidate for governor and others are talking about are shutting down the economy.
What Woody Myers said this week was going back to stage four, or potentially three if things continue to get worse, which is not shutting
down
the
entire
economy, but it is imposing a lot more restrictions than we currently have. There is no doubt that individual responsibility and individual actions make all of this work. And that's been true since the start of the pandemic. But what I don't understand that stuck out to me about what Governor Holcomb said this week was, the line that stuck out, and I think that's the line I use in my story, is the blanket approach has been proven not to work. Isn't that what Indiana was doing for 7 months that Governor Holcomb touted? How can you now say the blanket approach doesn't work?
Well, I think that's the problem for him. When you look at the criteria that he established, they were not forced on him. These were not, you know, some sort of standards that somebody in Washington or somewhere else said, you will adhere to these standards. These will be your benchmarks. These are ones largely that he and the experts that he consulted in the State Department of Health said that these are what we're going to be, these are the beacon that we'll follow, the guide in terms of whether we're going to loosen the guidelines or keep them tight. And in fact, it was because of those very things that we saw adjustments in the original timetable. Remember, it was going to be Independence Day, 4th of July. We were all going to be, quote unquote, back to normal. But because the numbers and the trends were not what he had outlined in terms of his own criteria, he backed away from that. So I think that's problematic. I think if you looked at maybe we just didn't read it right when he put out the original criteria, because if you look down, I think there's an asterisk. And it says, but within 30 days of an election, that's a different that shifts it. I don't want to be cynical, but you do have to ask yourself if this were not on the eve of an election, if there would be the same kind of pressure to keep things open.
Well, and to that point, Nikki, I mean, the press conference Wednesday, we had seen these numbers getting worse. They kept getting worse. We were setting record after record after record for new cases. He started off with nearly 10 minutes talking about the need for people to be more responsible, how things were getting worse, how the situation was getting more dire in certain parts of the state, and that we all needed to do better. Then we transitioned to finding out that Dr. Chris Box, the state health commissioner, has tested positive. This is a person who takes this very seriously and does the right things. She tested positive, as well as her daughter and her grandson, and of course we hope that they're all going to be okay. And then we go to Dr. Lindsay Weaver from the health department, who lays out the four guiding principles, how all of them are not going the way we want. And then he says, but we're staying at stage five.
Yeah, and that's the confusion, is he's done a complete 180 from this sort of blanket statewide approach to more targeted talking to counties. And there are some counties that are worse than others, but all the counties are, you know, every week we get more in the orange. Every week we get more, you know, going toward the yellow. So, and we're not even doing something as simple as, for instance, limiting visitation at nursing homes. But that's still wide open in the middle of this. So I just think he has done a poor job of explaining, you know, this 180 he did, and I think it's about the election, but I'm not even sure why. His polling shows he's not even anywhere near being challenged.
I mean, I think most people expect him to coast to re-election. So I see the election argument made not just on this show, but a lot of places. Oh, he's worried about if I were Eric Holcomb, I wouldn't be worried about re-election. I would just be worried about the numbers. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, do you believe the state is currently doing everything it should to address COVID-19? A yes or B no. Last week's question, will the vice presidential debate have any impact on the race? Just 38% of you say it will, 62% of you say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. A recent report says school funding gaps between students based on income status and race are widening under Indiana's state funding model. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains the report also makes recommendations to change course.
The report says spending gaps between wealthier and low-income schools are getting bigger, largely because changes state lawmakers have made to the school funding formula in the past decade. Claire Fidian Green is CEO of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, which commissioned the study. She says changes made in 2015 has meant schools spend even less on low-income kids.
Since 2015, the overall per-pupil funding level for students from low-income households has dropped by 35%.
But the analysis did come with a set of recommendations. Fidian Green says the most critical is for the state to distribute funding based on a community's local wealth.
He did it right away. You did a great job. Jennifer Hollowell, do you foresee the funding formula changing in the upcoming budget session?
I'll be really surprised if it does, just because it's really complicated and we have so many things that legislators are going to be facing, figuring out how to deal with, kind of the fallout of the pandemic and trying to meet budget needs. Everything's kind of on the table for cutting except for education. Obviously, the governor has come out and said that he's not going to allow cuts there, so you at least have fully committed education funding, but to work through trying to make changes to the school funding formula, I just think is probably too big of a task that's not going to make it with all the other big tasks that they have.
Yeah, is this, if you were someone who wanted to see funding, a change to the funding formula, is 2021 the wrong session for that?
I think that we need to make some very tough decisions, okay? This administration and the previous administration's approach was to throw money at wild ideas like virtual education across the board, not because of a pandemic, but just in general, at charter schools, at vouchers, and they've taken the increase in state funding and they funneled it out of the traditional public education that educates 93% of the population. And that's what's causing this problem. There's a 35% decrease in funding to the schools who need it most, who don't have a property tax base that can go ahead and do a referendum and make a difference. You have townships like Wayne Township, for example, which is not a rich township in Marion County, and it pays almost double what Carmel pays for its property taxes in an effort to try to deal with the fact that they've had money taken from them since 2008 on. And the problem is compounded by the fact that when you look at these studies, from 2004 to date, Indiana is dead last in the country in its raises for teachers. Dead last. What do you need in those public schools where you're educating people whose English isn't the first language or poorer students who don't have the support at home? You need great teachers, and you need to pay those great teachers, and we're not doing it.
Jennifer talked about how the governor has protected K-12 schools from cuts, and that's certainly true in the current budget year. Everything else he's asking, well, except for like DCS, he's asking for a 15% cut across the board to deal with, obviously, the pandemic and the economic struggles that have come with it. But...
yeah, that doesn't count the new budget that they're
right.
going to craft. And while I certainly agree that Republicans are a huge fan of the whole dollars following the child thing, they're not going to move away from that. But here's a simple thing they could do without throwing everything into turmoil. Last year, they put less money into the complexity index, which helps schools in poor districts so that they could put more money in the state-based tuition support formula. That's a simple thing that they could do that doesn't completely change the entire formula, but you're just putting more money targeted toward those districts that are moving further away.
Not just in education, but across the board, the pandemic has sort of highlighted and exacerbated existing disparities across in every facet of our society. So because of that extra spotlight then, does this actually make it a little more likely that a change like what Nikki just talked about might be possible in the upcoming state budget?
Some tweaking, maybe some things like that with the complexity aspect of this, the formula. But nothing as fundamental as let's change the way we fund our schools. There is no way, even if we had never had the first sneeze or chill or high fever because of COVID, that's something that would take, you know, that's one of these things that just takes...
A five-year study committee.
Oh, at least 10-year study.
10 years.
But I would point out this, that shows you how challenging it can be to be try to hold people to consistency. Many of the people who are, of course, now being criticized for the disparities are the same people who have said, Republican lawmakers, their mantra has been, kids' educational fortunes should not be determined by their zip codes. And of course, that's the argument that they have made for vouchers and the funding of, that goes to private schools that seemingly are an alternative in advocates of school choice's mind to for underperforming schools. But I mean, what is a better example of having your educational fortunes determined by zip code than what we're seeing here?
And what do you do for poor rural school districts that don't have the voucher opportunities?
That's an increasingly louder conversation, I think. Indiana is now included under Chicago's COVID-19 emergency travel order. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Anguiano reports beginning Friday, those traveling between the two states will need to quarantine for 14 days unless they're exempt.
Chicago Department of Public Health Commissioner Dr. Allison Arwoody says states are added to Chicago's emergency travel order list if they have an average of more than 15 new COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents daily. The city's website lists Indiana as currently having 20 to 30 new daily cases per 100,000 residents.
Obviously, the Indiana news is of significance to many people in Chicago.
Hoosiers traveling to Chicago must quarantine unless they work there. Other exceptions for permissible travel include medical care and parental shared custody. The city's Department of Health is urging Chicago residents to not travel to states on the list. Individuals found in violation of the order are subject to fines.
John Schwanes, last I checked, I didn't have to go through a border check when I was traveling back home to Chicago. Is this at all enforceable?
No. I mean, they're lucky if they can get people to, you know, not to try to outdo them with the easy pass and at the right. Toll booth. No, is the short answer.
Ohio's done the same thing now.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not just Chicago, it's Ohio too. And I mean, aside from, I don't know if you have a really ticked off neighbor or ex-boyfriend who might turn you in, I think it's these places are trying to make a point, but they really don't have any practical impact.
It's not as if these places are also immune from the coronavirus. Things are getting worse in Illinois, even if not Chicago itself. Is even sending the message really all that meaningful? Well,
I think it's just Illinois giving the finger to Indiana. After all the years where we're saying, oh, we're so much better than that terrible, corrupt, overtaxed Illinois, I think they're just saying, yeah, well, you need to get your act together, too. I think that's kind of cute,
but
frankly.
To be fair,
Illinois is still pretty corrupt. Does this really, I mean, Governor Hogan was asked about this at his press conference, and he said exactly what you would expect him to say, which is, they're doing what they think is best, I'm doing what I think is best. Is this really meaningful at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there are 25 states, like half the country is on this list that's not allowed to go to Chicago. But also, I believe the Chicago public health official, in citing things, falsely claimed that Indiana doesn't have a mask mandate and that we aren't operating certain things that are not even accurate. So again, it was more.
Well, we don't have an enforced mask.
More.
Maybe that's your
bad info in Illinois.
All right. Well, Indiana's three gubernatorial candidates will meet for the first of two debates next week. Republican Governor Eric Holcomb, Democrat Dr. Woody Myers, and Libertarian Donald Rainwater will meet Tuesday for a debate moderated by political scientist Andrew Downs. The gubernatorial debates are organized and run by the Indiana Debate Commission. Questions are gathered by the commission from Hoosier voters. Unlike past years, however, there will be no in-person audience for this year's debates due to COVID-19. The second gubernatorial debate this year will be the following Tuesday, October 27th, moderated by political scientist Nadia Brown.
Nikki Kelly, hundreds of thousands of Hoosiers will have voted before the first of these debates. Do they need to be moved up in the calendar?
Yeah, I mean, they could move them up a week or so, but there's clearly, you know, far more people are going to vote closer to the election or on election day. And I don't think you can have everything out, like every preview story, every debate story out before October 6th. I think that's part of the thing about early voting is that's the one negative you could say is that if something monumental happened in a race, you can't get that vote back.
Will these debates have much of an impact?
I don't think so. I think we've seen the trend lines are pretty well established in these races. Normally, I talk about conventional wisdom, which, of course, that doesn't apply much anymore. Typically, you would think that a lot of people don't start paying attention, and certainly until Labor Day and beyond, and that's when they start focusing. I think this is different in part because of what's happening in Washington. It's a referendum largely on the Trump administration, which, of course, trickles down to a certain extent to other races. It can't help but trickle down. So even though I don't think people are necessarily lumping, you know, the three gubernatorial candidates in Indiana into that sort of referendum, it is forcing people probably to look at their choices and consider their choices in a manner that maybe is more expedited than they might have in the past. So I'm not against debates. I love debates. The more the better. But I don't think necessarily, barring some crazy, crazy surprise, I don't think
which
they'll have
has happened in past
we
debates.
Have debates. There's a certain U.S. Senate,
gubernatorial debate. For debate a while. Yeah. If you're advising Governor Holcomb as he heads into these two debates, what do you tell him is the key to doing the job he needs to do?
Well, I mean, I think he's obviously a very good communicator and on message. So I think it's just sticking to that message discipline and highlighting all the accomplishments that he's had over the last 4 years. And then, you know, in talking about COVID and the recovery plan, and I think he'll do great. In terms of the timing, I think if we're going to vote for 30 days, perhaps we should space the debates out more, but I think campaigns are probably happy to do either way.
Yeah. If you're advising Dr. Woody Myers, what do you tell him about how to utilize these debates?
Oh, I think what he does is stand up there and show and communicate the fact that he is the most qualified person to lead the state, particularly in a pandemic like this, and that he is prepared not only with the facts and the knowledge and the experience that he's had through the years, but also because he's prepared to lead in sharp contrast with Eric Holcomb. He's prepared to stand up there and take a position. He doesn't have to have a study commission to do this and another committee to do that and report back in 3 or 4 years and tell us what the results are. He's prepared to act. And that's what we need in Indiana, particularly now in the middle of this pandemic. We need somebody who's prepared to stand up there and put Hoosiers first.
Of course,
you
need a legislature willing to act with him.
Well, that's always the trick about any executive position, isn't it?
We may get that.
I want to ask you something else, Nikki. You've covered a lot of these debates over the years. What are you most interested in hearing about at the debates? We don't know what the questions will be. They were sent in by Hoosiers. What are you most interested in hearing them answer?
You know, I have relatively good access to all of them. So and obviously we've been hearing from Governor Holcomb, you know, consistently for months upon months upon months.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure. I mean, maybe a little more on the environmental front would be good. I think we know where they stand on COVID. I think we know where they stand on some education issues. So maybe we need to branch out a little there.
Yeah. You can't always guarantee the person has been following what we've written or what they or this show or anything else like that. But beyond
really?
The obvious, I know, it's hard to believe. Beyond the obvious, what would you hope to hear out of one of these debates?
I want the surprises. And that's why I love this kind of format where the questions come from the general public. Because journalists, we tend to, we ask the questions that sort of are the standard operating procedure. And they're legitimate questions. They're the important issues. But I love it when somebody from, you know, Angola, Terre Haute, wherever, asks this question that everybody said, wow, that's a great question. No, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
And actually makes people think.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm looking forward to.
All right. Well, finally, it's very unlikely we'll see the kind of interruptions and talking over of fellow candidates and moderators at the gubernatorial debates that we've seen in the presidential and vice presidential debates this year. But Jennifer Hollowell, that being said, if you had to come up with a way to deal with those interruptions, what creative solution would you propose?
I think a creative and really effective solution might be a super soaker water gun.
I like that. That's what we do with our cats. Unfortunately, one of the cats seems to enjoy it, which kind of defeats the purpose. What would you be doing if you were moderating?
Well, I think I'd like a button that gave a 15-second warning and then shut the microphone off.
Oh, that's not very creative, though. Oh, I want something more fun. Goop falling down on their heads.
Can we bring back the gong from the gong show, like off to the
there
side?
There we go.
Well, if you want people tuning in, electric shock is clearly what we
need. I asked for creative solutions, and that's a creative solution.
I guarantee ratings would be twice what they've been in the past.
All right, well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.